March 9th. Okay, and I am going to open a public hearing on 2944 and 2945, so that we can have testimony from the members that are here, and then we'll go back to the orders of business that we have in front of the committee, and after that we'll take public testimony. Just so everyone knows what's going on, I don't want any surprises, no surprises in the Rules Committee. So with that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2944 and House Bill 2945. Erin, can you review the measures?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2944 requires Legislative Assembly or Secretary of State to hold public hearings throughout the state prior to adopting congressional or legislative reapportionment plans. And then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2945 requires Legislative Assembly or Secretary of State to provide any data purchased or used to create congressional or legislative apportionment plans.
Representative Parrish.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, representative from House District 37, Westland Tualatin. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard today on these two bills, and I'm going to be really brief because there are people who are much more eloquent that are here today to testify about these bills, as they were really originated with Portland City Club and Common Cause, Oregon, and others who are interested in the redistricting process. Only about half of the committee was here in 2011 when we did our redistricting. I think that redistricting in 2011 was sort of flukish, and that we had a very closely registered Senate. We had a tied House. And there was a lot of motivation and incentive to really work together and come up with maps that we could move forward that weren't going to get through a legal snag or to ask the Secretary of State to write those maps. We saw where we had not been able to do congressional and legislative maps in decades prior to that, and we were one of the only states that year that I think the only state that year that did not have legal challenges to their maps. I do not foresee that in 2020 that the same circumstances will be there, and I think now is the opportunity to really memorialize some of the things that we did, expand some of those things in terms of public hearings, map transparency, make sure that we do that now while we're sort of, none of us are really thinking about redistricting. Maybe some of us won't even be here when we do the next round of redistricting. I counted the other day, and I think I'm like the 29th most senior person in the building, so that means we've had a lot of turn for us to move up the ladder that quickly, and a lot of newcomers who were not a part of that process, and maybe a few of us barely be around the next time we do redistricting. So 2944 looks at the public hearing standards and creates a system of having additional public hearings, more probably than we had when we actually did redistricting. And 2945 looks at the maps. There is a dash one amendment, which you should have. Jennifer sent that over to committee services this morning. And so the dash one would replace the bulk of the bill for 2945. And so I'm, like I said, going to zip back to committee unless there's any questions. I know there's a similar bill on the public meeting that you're going to hear from. Rep. Leininger and Rep. McClain are on, but the folks really truly from the City Club and Common Cause, I think, can do a much better job of bringing these bills forward, as we've been working on these drafts on their behalf.
Okay, so before, just so that you can go on to doing the, I know everyone has committees that they're supposed to be in. Are there any questions on these two bills for people here before we move on to the next one? Okay.
Brief,
anybody so. Comments? No? So I close and then.
Unusual.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would just state for the record, I was the chair of the redistricting committee in 2001. So I'll be interested to hear these bills. I remember very poignantly, even after all these years, the process. So thank you.
So, Madam Chair, Representative memory? Wilson, we'll hope that you'll be here in 2020 for the next round. You missed a round then.
It's a little late for me.
You know, these bills don't go take us as far as I'd like to see. There is a bill around independent redistricting process. That would be a referral to the people. I absolutely support that as well. That's not these two bills, but I think these bills are a good start and move us that direction. So thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearings on 2944 and 2945 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2974.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle and members of the committee. We are here with a bill that was a concept that was brought to us by Common Cause and the Portland City Club and some other people who care very much about trying to codify the good work that was done in the last redistricting process in which hearings were held around the state so that...
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Sorry, thank you.
Thank you. Normally my co-chair, my vice chair would do that, so...
He's complaining he has a knee injury, but I think it's higher up.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you
very much. Ann Leininger, representative for House District 38. So this bill concept would codify some really great work that the redistricting group did last time through. Specifically, it would focus having public hearings in the communities in which the most significant changes of population have occurred so that those very communities in which lines might be shifted and adjusted can speak to what aspects of their community they think would enable best, what lines would enable their community to be best represented. It enables them to weigh in before, it enables them to weigh in after. We've got some good bipartisan support for the bill, and again, we like Representative Parrish, are bringing this bill at the request of some good people who care about a fairer and positive redistricting process.
Madam Chair, my name is Susan McLean, and I'm from House District 29, and I'm here today to support this particular House Bill 2974. And the basics have been explained, and I know that the redistricting process is not simple, and it's one of those items that seem to be kind of a hot button almost every time that it happens. And so one of the reasons that I particularly support this particular House Bill 2974 is because it really looks at doing more community outreach. It really looks at doing better types of hearings where you're really getting people who are going to have the changes happen to their particular community or getting a chance to weigh in. And also because I think it really does help with our goal of transparency, and it helps with our goal of really trying to bring trust to our government. And we're showing them that we really want to be able to represent them and the communities that they think have some likenesses to them and some communities that have and people and folks who have things in common, that we're able to hear what they have to say about those issues. I know that there are some of the representatives, for example, that really are representing six or seven, different groups of folks. And there are some that have a little bit more compact districts like my own, where I have Cornelius, Forest Grove, and West Hillsboro. But I think the folks that are going to see the changes in redistricting should have an opportunity to weigh in and really help us with this transparency and with this good outreach to the public. So I thank you very much, and I hope you'll consider this work.
Thank you so much. With that, I'm going to close public hearing on 2974, and we'll open that up afterwards. And I am going to open a work session on House Bill 3037. Erin, remind us about the measure.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3037 was heard on March 2nd, and it modifies public record law exemption for required disclosure of certain personal information of public employees and public body volunteers to remove mandate for disclosure upon showing that public interest would require disclosure in particular instances. Requires certain personnel information of home care workers, operators of child care facilities, exempt family child care providers, operators of adult foster homes, and those who submitted voluntary information in confidence to public body be maintained confidentially and not disclosed pursuant to a public records request. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We have a -1 amendment. It excludes the Oregon Judicial Department and Oregon Department of Transportation or any records in their custody from public records disclosures exemptions for home care workers, operator of child care facility, family child care providers, and operator of adult foster homes. We have a no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact. No statement was issued on the -1 amendment. There was a hand engrossed copy of the measure posted on OLIS for you to review. I would just call your attention to section or page 8, which is where the amendment is affected. And that is what's before you today, Madam Chair.
Okay. comments or questions on this bill? Yes, Representative McLean.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle. I did review the information submitted by SEIU and AFSCME. I do have a question.
Happy to bring them up.
Yes.
Call up Melissa Unger and. I looked. I was like, "You're not Joe Basler."
For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEIU Local 503. I'll listen to the question if it's too complicated. I did have a lawyer just in case this time, so that I did not get tripped up.
Mike, over.
You would like me to move the mic over here. Thank you, Chair Hoyle.
Thank you, Ms. Unger. Does SEIU ever use the information that it obtains through its collective bargaining agreement for any campaign purposes during political campaigns?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, we mail represented workers about endorsement decisions that members make.
And may I follow up? When you email members, I'm assuming that's just union members, that doesn't include fair share representatives?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, when we email members, we can only use personal email addresses, and that's not actually information that we get around anything political. We can't email any work email addresses around political things. So that's voluntary information that people submit when they do membership applications. Emails, we will mail representative workers about endorsed candidates, and so that they're represented. So we will mail people around endorsed candidates, and that would include members and people who are just represented, meaning that they are fair share members. Fair share.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand this. So SEIU obtains the home information on fair share state workers, or those workers who by law you represent but who have chosen not to be a member of the union, and you use that information to contact them about who you endorse in political campaigns.
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean. So kind of would be the way I would respond. So we get a list of all of the people that we represent. Our members go through an endorsement process where they talk with candidates and they endorse someone. And then we will mail members and fair share members both about those endorsement decisions. And so, yes. I mean, I think that's the question you're asking me. And so we will mail them about endorsement decisions that our members make on certain candidates throughout the state.
Okay.
And Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, if I can add one thing, I think that all of the information that we mail them, I would like people, when they engage, they can, you know, there's sometimes where members or fair share members or both will be asked to be taken off our mailing list, and we will comply with that, and we then don't mail them. So we do have like a do not mail list.
Question. So if this bill were not to pass, say we didn't pass this bill into law, would you still have access to the same information?
Chair Hoyle, yes. This bill doesn't change any of this doesn't change any of the collective bargaining information that we currently have. It's about public information that's available on public workers and workers who work through the government and people who work with the government.
So, Madam Chair, I guess this is my point. This bill would prohibit somebody who wasn't endorsed by SEIU from contacting or getting the information to contact state workers, and yet SEIU would be allowed, along with AFSCME, to continue to contact. While I understand, there's two parts to this bill. One part is to protect identity. Is it code enforcement? Is that correct?
Home care workers, welfare workers.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative McLean,
code enforcement was
House Bill 2208.
Okay.
This one just pertains to home care workers, adult foster care homes.
Okay. So that part would prevent their information. Then the other part of the bill prevents all public employees, residential addresses, et cetera, from being disclosed to any third party. And my concern is that how does this not give SEIU and AFSCME advantages in partisan political campaigns? And of course, this is a work session, right? So we're allowed to discuss this at this point?
We can have a discussion.
Okay.
Absolutely. I could have just moved it without discussion, but I won't do that, and I don't do that in this committee.
Thank you, Madam
I don't think
Chair.
That's fair.
Thank you. So maybe you can help, or someone on the committee can help me understand how this doesn't give a political advantage to the public employee unions, especially in the fact that they're able to contact with endorsements, recommendations of fair share participants, people who have specifically said, I don't want to be a part of the union.
Ms. Unger?
Representative Hoyle, Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, there's two different types of fair share members. There's definitely people on fair share who have said proactively, I don't want to be a part of a union. But there's lots of people who actually just didn't sign up, and we find that all the time. And so we actually talk with our members all of the time, and they just never had the opportunity to sign up, or they didn't get their member packet, and they didn't, get that form in time. I mean, I just want to point out that it's not that everyone who's a fair share payer is not someone who has chosen not to be a member of our union. There's lots of times where they have just not actually filled out the form, and they often will fill out the form once asked very quickly. And that's just one of the differences of people who have not done it. And I think I would also just say that, I mean, if there's this is not our intent of this bill. Our intent of this bill is who you heard testify at this last meeting. It's been brought to us by child welfare workers and other workers who are worried about their privacy. They asked us to move forward this bill so that they could feel that there was protection on their public records. I mean, that really is the intent of this bill. I don't know if there's other things we can do to make that clear. That is clearly our intent of this bill. So I do want to just put that on the record.
Representative Rayfield, then Representative McLean.
I think in response to Representative McLean, as I look at this, there's many organizations already present across the country, across the state, where you're not going to get access to membership information. You look at could look at any number of the, American Heart Association or a lot of other different associations that you can become a member of that may endorse a candidate. The American Heart Association is probably a very bad example, but various organizations that lobby to their members, these are their endorsed candidates, yet a private individual isn't able to get access to those membership lists to be able to talk about this. This to me seems to be an entity that has a connection with certain groups because you're representing them that doesn't necessarily have a duty to disclose, I guess, all of the members. And so I guess I'm not
So you mean like the Trial Lawyers Association or something like
that? Yeah, absolutely. For instance, let's just say, those types of organizations, they can endorse candidates and speak directly to their members. I view that as kind of a very similar situation. I'll just leave it at that.
And what percentage of the contact with your members is political versus representing your members' other work? I mean, what else are those? What else is that contact information used for?
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, we contact our members about a lot of things. I mean, most of our union spends most of their time representing them. We're a very small team of people who actually do the work of politics within our union, and so we contact them about their rights and responsibilities as union members or fair share payers. Both have rights and responsibilities under the law and in the contract, and so we communicate with them about those. We also communicate with them about union elections, where they get to elect people. We make sure that both members get to vote, and then fair share people know that there's an election going on that they can vote in if they are members. So we communicate with them regularly on an annual basis throughout the year all the time about all their rights and responsibilities, and we represent them, and so we also communicate with them about the bargaining process so that right now, as we bargain for them, we communicate with them about all the different bargaining that's going on and what the decisions are made, and they can take bargaining surveys, and we make sure that they can do that online or in the mail.
Representative McClain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. because of the forced representation aspect of public employees, in addition to the fact that these are taxpayers' funds that are employing folks, I draw a distinction. But it does seem to me to be very, very troubling when the SEIU and AFSCME, and especially SEIU, is almost exclusively pro-Democratic Party candidates, certainly in all swing elections. And then we're, and if you want to contact and rebut what is partisan politics by the SEIU, you're now forbidden from knowing this information that's listed in subsection 3, but SEIU has it, and they get to use it for political purposes. And I think that's unfair, and it's certainly troubling to me, and it's cloaked in the name of trying to protect healthcare workers. I'm troubled by the means as well as the ends.
Sure, thank you. Any other questions, Representative Nose?
A comment, Madam Chair.
Yep.
I just want to say I'm sure it's a big shock to Representative McClain, but I feel completely the exact opposite. We heard very powerful, compelling testimony from people who are doing a very important and difficult job, who experience trauma for their families because of the things that they're doing, and I just couldn't disagree with your assertion further. This is not about public sector unionism or Democrat or Republicans. This is about people who just want to be able to have their children play in their front yard. And I'm sorry, but like, we heard pretty compelling testimony about that.
On another bill.
No, this bill.
No,
this bill.
Code enforcement.
And on this bill.
On this bill.
By AFSCME members who talked about, and SEIU members who talked about doing child welfare work, who are stalked and scoped.
Don't chastise
me. You are.
Representative Nose, make a point.
Apologies.
Make a point.
Hey, Madam Chair.
Yes.
You know, this is my point. Why are we cloaking this in a bill that has no one in opposition to wanting to protect health care workers or child care workers? No one's arguing against that. But I pointed out the net effect of a completely different provision is to give a distinct political advantage to the SEIU and AFSCME. And so if it's not the intent of the bill, then why is it there? Or then perhaps SEIU should be able to send out rebuttals of candidates. For an example, it's not just partisan candidates, but as you know, tax initiatives, one proposed by Our Oregon, which is funded by SEIU, is going to go out and ask for tax increases. If SEIU says to its people that it has home information on it, hey, vote for this tax increase, how's that fair?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McClain, if that was a question, is that a question?
No, I guess. I mean,
if you'd like to respond, you are welcome to respond.
Representative Hoyle, Representative McClain, SEIU, I mean, I hope everyone has had the opportunity to engage. We do really take our member-led process very seriously and our democratic process very seriously. And so we have really complex union elections where people get elected. We make sure that we send out candidate questionnaires and go through a candidate endorsement process that is very serious. I do think this bill does not impact any of the ways that our union works and those realms. It really is about what our members came and testified to the other day, which was specifically child welfare workers being really concerned about safety. We have another bill that's about stalking of child welfare workers that's being considered this session, this legislative session that will be up in 2 weeks, because they right now do get stalked and have to pay for their own restraining orders, and we think that's a concern. So this bill came from the bill around the stalking piece and realizing that public information was still out there, and then also around the idea that social security numbers for home care workers and all those folks currently is not protected under public information. So that is but this bill doesn't, I mean, it doesn't change anything that we have been doing, and we do really do take the democratic process, whether it's a ballot measure or candidate that goes through an elected body of members for every decision that we make. And we give every member an opportunity to vote, and we also make sure that when people are not yet members, that they have the opportunity to know that they can vote if they would like to become members. And we really do take that process very seriously and follow all the rules that have been laid out before us to do it.
Madam Chair, can I ask one question?
Yeah.
So, Ms. Unger, if I oppose SEIU's advocacy for the tax increase initiative that Our Oregon is doing, how do I get access to the contact information for the public employees that you have the contact information for and are going to support it? How do I contact them after this bill?
Representative Hoyle, Representative McClain. I think that right now, I don't necessarily know if anyone has ever asked to just contact a list of public employees about a tax measure, but my understanding is that if you ever wanted to talk with our members, that we would encourage you to do so and bring you in to talk with our members. We at SEIU have a pretty strict privacy policy around the information that's like ever handed to us, as I think that most people would expect us to because that information has been handed to us to make sure that we're doing our jobs as their union, and so we have a strict privacy policy around the information that we are given from SEIU.
Ms. Unger, I have another question based on something that you had just said. So right now, because of another law that was passed, people who work for the state, their names, their job title, how much they make, and how much their retirement is all open to public record.
Representative Hoyle, that's correct.
So what this protects is their home address, and for home health care workers, their Social Security numbers. Is that correct? Because that is right now open to could be publicly requested. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Melissa, I don't know if you can answer this, but I'll ask. First of all, I was quite I don't know if the word's impressed, but moved by the testimony and the indication that you've said that the purpose behind this bill is protection for folks who are currently not. If there is an unintended consequence, I'm curious to go back and say and ask how many folks approximately, percentage-wise, I don't know what the right answer would be affected by this bill, so that I can get a scale of what we're talking about, because I feel like we're talking about entire lists, and I believe that we're not.
Hoyle, Representative Gilliam, I do actually think that, I mean, the way that it really does protect people who are employed in the public, by the public. So it does protect a lot of lists. I don't know if list is the right word, but people. It protects a lot of people from their public information being requestable by a public information request. And it is, so it does protect like their personal information off of public information requests. And so it is a lot. I mean, I don't know how many people, but it is a lot of people that currently work for public bodies that this information is currently public requestable. I don't think that's a word, but that is request. You can
it
request
is now.
By the way. Thank you.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I'm just trying to remind myself about the testimony. does this bill, I'll use the word narrow, does it narrowly define who would be added to the additional protection?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Gilliam. So this bill, so there's two different bills that were heard the day that this bill was heard. One would just in, was civil
code.
Civil code enforcement officers. And then this one is about what information is requestable on people who work for the a public body. And so the other ones kind of limit, like the one on OHSU, for instance, limits like where they work. You can't get information about where they work. You can't get information about anything on them. But this bill is about like what kind of personal information becomes public on any public person who works for a public body. So the other one was about adding someone to the exemption list. This is not about exempting certain people. People's names and work addresses and work email addresses would all still be public under this. It is about what kind of information is publicly available on them, and that limits the personal private information that's publicly available on them.
So for the purposes of our thinking about this bill, certain information, which would be the narrow part, but any public entity would be the wide part.
Mm-hmm. And that goes beyond what is already publicly available, which is quite a lot. Okay, any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Okay, I'll accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill
3036. No, not you.
All right. He was getting slow with it.
Madam Chair.
There's a process. There's a process, Representative Rayfield.
First, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 3037.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved to adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 3037. Further discussion? Objection? Okay. If not, motion passes. And I'll accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3037 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Is there further discussion? Yes.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think by evidenced by Representative Noss and I's exchange is that there is no dispute in wanting to protect child care workers. Every instance where I've heard that the issue was not whether the behavior that they endured was criminal or not, it was criminal. It's harassment. There are laws already in place to protect them. But the fact is that the access to their information is what's being asked to protect, and I distinguish the two. Because of the emotional connection that we all feel with people who have their a child threatened or, you know, things like that, it's hesitant to want to stand up and question. I've stood up to question SEIU specifically because it uses information, even on those who don't want to be members of the union, and it uses it for advocacy of political positions. And so if you have a difference of an opinion with SEIU, which has a track record, frankly, of supporting almost uniformly one political party. But even when you ignore that, when you look at the tax measures that SAU's one of their investments is in a group called Our Oregon, and its plans to ask for $2 billion from our taxpayers. And that is going to be very divisive in Oregon. So they have an advantage. And because they have used information that they received in collective bargaining, and the fact that they can then use that information to promote partisan or if not political positions on the ballot, troubles me when everyone else is now locked out of that information. That's my whole reason for having issues with this bill. It's not solved. I think the reality of the unfairness of that is pronounced, but yet completely repressed because of the urgency in which we are going to protect identity and of child care workers and the others, which again is no dispute. You know, if it's not the intent of the public employee unions to use that for their political advantages, then I would urge them to publicly disavow it and either come out and say they're not going to use it, or at least say that they will willingly ship out the contrary views to the membership and to the fair share payments. This ballot initiative process on tax increases is going to be incredibly divisive. And so I'm troubled by that. I'm troubled by the fact that folks who don't want to be a part of the union are nonetheless subjected to partisan campaigning by them. That's the reason why I have asked for this information. The fact that I brought it out in the face of such an urgency to protect our workers was simply because I think if that's an unintended consequences, then it may be perhaps no more it can be unintended. It's a consequence. But I am in favor of protecting the private information of our workers that are engaged in the very volatile nature of when you remove a child from the home or things like that. It's when such criminal behavior is being done, and then I can understand, I think it's a very reasonable request to want to say, let's not make it easy for that behavior, and we should protect the information of them.
And for the record, I don't for 1 minute question your intent or motive or wanting to protect people who really do need protection. So I believe everything you're saying is true and understand where you're coming from. Representative Wilson.
I decline. Sorry.
Representative Gilliam.
One more comment, and that is I would like to repeat a concern I had that I believe is shared by certainly SEIU and this committee. But just to reiterate, this is one thing we can do, and it's important that I think we do it for the original intent of this bill. But let us not forget what we can do either in partnership, either in awareness, either in training, on all the other ways people can get the information and do harm to the people we're trying to protect. Because this bill is one step. It is not the full armor. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. With that, Zoe, will you please call the roll?
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Kenmer.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Rayfield?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith Connor?
Aye.
Chair Hoyle?
Aye. And I'll carry the bill. Motion passes. And I'll close the work session on 3037. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to open the work session on HCR 13. Erin, will you explain where we're at?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, HCR 13 is the measure we heard on Friday commemorating the 100th anniversary of the McKinley Elementary School. We did receive late Friday afternoon a Dash 2 amendment and didn't have the paperwork on it to move on Friday. We now have the no fiscal, no revenue impact of the Dash 2 amendment, which replaces the original resolution. There is a hand-engrossed copy available to you on OLIS, so you can read the resolution in its current composition, and that is what is before you this afternoon.
I'd accept a motion from Vice Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I give the motion, separate from the children that I think were here on Friday, I hope there was no disparaging comments about the absence of one of your vice chairs.
No, there were disparaging comments for everybody that was missing. No, that's not true. I will say that Representative Frederick and Gomberg were here for two other bills, and I had them come up because it was absolutely the best hearing we have ever had in this committee. We had like 50 to 75 children from McKinley Elementary. They made pictures. They came and told us about their school. It was really fantastic. And no disparaging comments were not made.
Your comments have restored my faith in the committee, and that is why I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment, correct?
Yes.
To HCR 13.
Any discussion or objections? Oh, no. Vice Chair Gilliam has moved to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to HCR 13. Discussion, objections? If not, the amendment is adopted. All right.
Madam Chair, if you will allow, I will move HCR 13 to the floor with a be adopted as amended recommendation.
Any discussion? Vice Chair Gilliam has moved HCR 13 with a be adopted as amended recommendation. Discussion? All right, objection? If not, bill passes, and Representative Clem will be the carrier. With that, we'll go back to our original bills. All right, I'm going to open public hearings for HB 2944, 2945, and 2974. And we're just getting the list of people. Okay, so House Bill 2945, I think we've got... I'm going to call all of you up because you're all signed up on a number of bills. So Kate Titus, James Offsink, and Norman Terrill.
Rep. Hoyle, can you clarify which of the bills are
Let's
all
start
three
with,
together?
They're all three together, so you can... if you, how would you like to do it? Do you want to all talk on 2945 and then on your next bill? I mean, because you're signed up for two different bills. What is your preference?
At least the two concepts we might be helpful to separate for
that.
That
sounds great. So let's start with 2945.
Data transparency.
Yes. And identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Hoyle, Vice Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony. My name's Kate Titus, and I'm here representing Common Cause. And some of you know that Common Cause is a 45-year-old nonpartisan organization that works to safeguard and improve the democratic process. It helps strengthen participation and faith in our institutions of self-government. I'd like to just mention Common Cause's role in redistricting so you understand why we're here today. Common Cause has a history of leadership on redistricting both at the national level and here in Oregon as well. During the last redistricting process, Common Cause here played a role in the redistricting process, both submitting input to the House and Senate redistricting committees, giving public input to the public through the media, and also helping to bring participation into the public hearings that were organized by the legislature. After the redistricting process was over, we wrote a report on that, analyzing what we felt worked and where there were areas for improving our redistricting process in this state. And this bill House Bill 2945 addressing data transparency actually addresses one of our top recommendations in that report. So that's why I'm here today. So let me speak to the bill. First of all, I want to clarify that this bill, 2945, as currently written, doesn't actually capture the intent that we had in mind. Common Cause and our Redistricting Matters Coalition partners miscommunicated with the legislative drafting about our proposal, and I think we didn't get quite what we wanted, but there is an amendment that's been proposed, and I think that more accurately reflects our goal. So I just want to clarify that we're speaking here to the amended bill and the concept that we're trying to achieve. Secondly, I want to thank Representative Parrish for her leadership on this bill. I appreciate that she readily understood the importance of this reform, stepped up early where others might have hesitated to take this on. I think this is a bill that requires a closer look to really fully appreciate it. And at first glance, it may raise some concerns that it would somehow handicap or embarrass the political parties or the legislature in the redistricting process. But I think if you look more closely at it, I believe that you'll come to see that this proposal is actually in everyone's interest. So let me speak to why Common Cause and our coalition supports this bill as amended. And I'll start by just explaining what we're trying to achieve here. So as district lines are redrawn during the redistricting process, every set of options involves some set of impacts or trade-offs affecting the partisan and other demographic breakdowns of the districts involved. It's inevitable. While legislators are prohibited from drawing the lines for the specific purpose to enhance the advantage of one party over the other, they needn't hide that such impacts inevitably exist and pretend that they're not there or not look at them. To the contrary, we think it's actually important that legislators need this information to do their job well and that the public needs it to be able to review what are the trade-offs and the impacts. So we think this information should be out in the open. Transparency enables legislators to make informed decisions. It enables the public to ensure that one side or another is not clearly gerrymandering the lines to shut out some set of voters based on political party or race or any other demographic. Transparency also helps the public to better appreciate how challenging the process is, even when everyone has the best of intentions. It's currently cost prohibitive for the public and very expensive for the political parties to access the basic information necessary to evaluate the impacts on party and basic demographics. The political parties do access this information. They spend, though, significant sums of money to do so. And that's something that helps evaluate the maps and the breakdown of different possibilities. But since they view this information secretly behind closed doors, it is in fact backroom dealing and not really an appropriate way for us to be conducting the process here in Oregon. Instead, Common Cause feels it should be acknowledged that it's both legal and necessary for legislators to understand how various redistricting options impact a range of demographics, as long as they do so out in the open. Oregon could make this basic data much more accessible both to the political parties and legislators and to the public simply by joining nearly every other state in the country in providing review and input to the Federal Census Bureau when it on precinct boundaries through the Bureau's Block Boundary Suggestion Program. Right now, we're one of two or three states that don't participate in that. If Oregon participated in this program, it would be possible to correlate census data down to the precinct level so that it could be easily correlated with Oregon voter files. This would enable both the parties and the public to access the data needed to consider the impact of various redistricting maps on basic demographics. Oregon could do even more to make the information useful by all, by making it available online or setting up an online interactive mapping site as some other states have done. The software is already out there, there's models. So this is something we could do here in Oregon as well. But the most important step is simply to use the current census process that exists so that the accurate data is easily available to all of us here. So to summarize, I just want to say I believe that HB 2945 on data transparency serves a number of important interests. It makes it clear that legislators can and must look at the data so that doesn't have to be a secret process. It brings the legislator discussion of the most basic data impacts out in the open, where it belongs and becomes legal and legitimate. It provides legislators and parties with one common set of data, basic data information, at little or no cost. And it allows the public to better evaluate the impacts of various options, increasing public appreciation for how challenging the process is while providing a check against gerrymandering. I think these are interests that serve all of us, but regardless, transparency is the right thing to do. So I'll just close by saying that Common Cause commends this committee for considering this bill today, and we urge you to vote to support it, vote it out of committee, so that your colleagues in the full chamber can consider it. Thank you.
But you have amendments on the way to better represent.
Yeah, as it will be amended.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very helpful, because reading through the bill initially, I couldn't figure out what you were getting at. But that's really helpful.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So you're saying there will be a dash two amendment then?
This is
the dash one, right?
Dash one is the right one.
The dash one is the right one. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there is no more amendments?
No. What you have?
What we have is what it is. Okay. Well, why don't
you? Well, there's another hand wiggling, so maybe there's some other answer.
We're quibbling even among ourselves as to whether this.
Well, we won't vote it out today, and we'll just all keep talking. But I'd love to hear from you. Sir,
thank you.
Identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. My name is James Offsink, and today I'm representing the City Club of Portland and the Redistricting Matters Coalition. We support House Bill 2945, providing an open and publicly reviewable redistricting process to Oregonians. We believe that House Bill 2945, as amended, will take an important step towards providing the public, or including the public, in a process that it has little oversight opportunities in the past. Since at least 1991, in advance of each redistricting, legislative leadership has made a decision whether to include election data from the voter file in the redistricting the redistricting database that's used to create the maps. The decision since at least 1991 to not include this information has created a two-tiered system. The first tier consists of those entities with a strong interest in specific redistricting outcomes that include and who have the means and the motives to pay for the expensive enterprise, as my colleague Kate Titus discussed, of mapping the data in the voter file to the census block districts or census block boundaries. This group could then use the combined model to produce and analyze draft maps. All other groups, including the media and the public, were in a less privileged tier with no ability to review changes to the demographic and political makeup of proposed districts. The amended House Bill 2945 has a few components, and I'm not going to go into detail since I think that Kate's done a wonderful job of kind of summarizing them. I do want to emphasize that the small administrative change in participating in the Block Boundary Suggestion Program, and as Kate mentioned, we're one of three states in 2006 for the 2010 census that did not participate. And this small administrative change does make the mapping easier for lots of parties, including down the line the county clerks, also political parties, interest groups, the media, et cetera. The second component of House Bill 2945 does require that the voter information included in the voter file be made public at the census block level. So we're not talking about providing that information for free to anyone who's interested in redistricting. That is something that the Secretary of State's office charges for currently, and there are, I think, good reasons to not have that at the individual level be made free. But this would be at the census block level so that redistricting maps could be reviewed through that lens. Legislators involved in the 2011 redistricting process described in interviews with our committee that the political registration data was a key negotiation item used to successfully produce the final district maps. While the 2011 Legislative Assembly is worthy of praise and commendation for the historic work in passing a final set of final maps, it's unfortunate that in Oregon, a crucial part of the success was divorced so completely from any public review.
Redistricting is a fundamentally political function, but by increasing transparency, welcoming outside review, and removing disparate tiers of access, we believe that the final product will be better for all Oregonians. Our groups are good government groups, and we believe in the long haul, good process benefits everyone. We thank the Rules Committee for considering this important issue and hope that you will agree that now is the time to establish the structural framework for an open and successful redistricting process in 2011. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I might also add that I was a member of the National Board of the League of Women Voters until recently. And I'm a computer software engineer, so I understand data very well. And I also aided in the advocacy for the Washington State redistricting reform during the 1980s. So I've been working on this for a long time. So the League of Women Voters is a 95-year-old grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The Oregon League conducted a study in 2007 on redistricting in Oregon, and there's a reference to it in my testimony. And by the way, I helped write that report along with Cap Eaton behind me. After a consensus process among Oregon members, the study concluded with a redistricting position, and I've included that for the record in my testimony. Part of the position says that the redistricting process should be subject to a reasonable and effective timetable and have an open and public process. Furthermore, the League has a long tradition of supporting improvements to representation of citizens and in transparency in government. During the last redistricting process in 2011, the Special Joint Committee on Redistricting actually used precinct-level data during its partisan negotiations, which resulted in the new district plans. However, this precinct data was not made public, and it was gathered and developed by political parties at great expense. It was also poorly correlated to the census block boundaries, and it had to be reconciled between the political parties before negotiations could even continue. So it actually delayed the process, the fact that it wasn't correlated with the precincts. The League believes that all precinct-level data used in the redistricting process should be made public and shared when it is first available with any interested persons or the media. Such data might include precinct registration data and voting history from the Secretary of State, or demographic data from the Census Bureau. The League believes that there are easy fixes for these issues. First is to require that Oregon join the Census Bureau's block boundary suggestion program, which we already discussed. This would virtually eliminate the costs associated with correlating the data, the precinct data, with the census blocks. Secondly, we should immediately make available any precinct level or census block data that is actually used in the redistricting process in the official committees. And that should be made available, say, on a committee website. Thirdly, we should also provide the same precinct data to the public in an online redistricting mapping tool similar to that provided by several states with excellent results. This would allow the public to participate in the process, to quickly evaluate various proposals, and even to make new proposals of their own. We recognize that the bill as currently written does not currently include the three concepts that I just espoused. This was because the Redistricting Matter Coalition did a poor job of communicating during the drafting of the original bill. We understand that an amendment has been drafted and does correct most of the issues that I think need to be in there. In any case, we urge you to move forward this bill on the subject in this session far ahead of the highly political time of the next redistricting process in 2021. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss these matters with you.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Kenema.
So I guess what I wasn't clear on, you think there are additional modifications need to be made to the Dash 1 amendments?
Representative Hoyle and Chair Hoyle and Representative Kenema, yeah, there's one little detail in the Section 2A that it talks about the data that comes from the registration file, and I believe that it should be any data that actually is used by the official committees in the process. I would call this the redistricting authority. It might be a committee of the legislature of the whole, the Secretary of State, or maybe an advisory committee for the Secretary of State. Whoever is doing the process should make all the data available when it's first being put in use.
Anyone else? Okay, with that, how about the next?
Anyone else who wants to testify on that concept? Because I think.
Yeah, is there, is Steve Carter, do you want to speak to this as well?
Is that the extent of the list?
It is, and then we're going to go back through again on the other. Yeah.
Just one.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stephen Carter. I'm a volunteer and member of the Executive Council of AARP Oregon. Most of what has been desired from our coalition in this bill has already been said. I just want you to know that the National AARP's first chapter in its policy handbook talks about government accountability and civic engagement and transparency in government, and therefore we totally endorse the concept of transparency in the redistricting process and the idea that all information used in the redistricting process will be available to the public at the time it's being used. So AARP Oregon urges passage of the amended bill. Thank you. Any questions?
Since you're already up, why don't you start testimony on the next bill, and which is, yes?
Can I make a request of this gentleman and the other testifiers on the other two bills? It would be helpful to me if, as part of your testimony, you would kind of give a comparison between the two different versions, because they are very close, and what you see is the pros and cons of each proposal. Let me go back to the chair for that question. He asked if it would be okay to go back to the testifying in the order they signed up, because there's a flow to it.
Oh, perhaps. Okay. Absolutely. So this would be House Bill 2974, which is the number of hearings that we should have and when they should happen. And this was the bill that Representative Leininger testified on?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Start with you.
Vice Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, you already know, but for the record, I'm Kate Titus representing Common Cause, and I won't go back over information about Common Cause, but I wanted to talk to you about why we're supporting House Bill 2974. During the last redistricting process, which Common Cause was engaged in, the legislature organized public hearings around the state, and these proved to be very useful both to the process itself and also to the public understanding and input in the process. I really respect the legislature and the leadership at the time for incorporating that, and we think that that's an excellent and pretty non-controversial tool to use in the redistricting process, to just open up and have public input and participation in the process, and so we'd like to see that institutionalized. I want to thank, first of all, Rep. Leininger for getting this concept drafted on the behalf of our redistricting coalition as outlined in the Common Cause recommendations. And I want to thank all three of the co-chief sponsors, Rep. Leininger, Rep. Hoyle, Rep. McClain, for submitting this bill on our behalf. There are some key provisions in it, what we think is important in this bill. First of all, it establishes public hearings as part of the process, which so that it's not just at the whim or that someone remembers to do it or thinks to do it. It specifies that hearings be held both before draft maps and after draft maps are available, and we think that's important to have both. It specifies at least 10 public hearings before and at least 5 held after drafting maps, which we thought was a sensible number. And then it specifies that the hearings be throughout the state, providing some latitude for how that could be handled, depending on what issues are at play in any redistricting cycle. And lastly, it provides for remote participation of people in these hearings through video equipment. These are provisions that we think are really useful in the bill. I want to speak briefly to the fact that there's two bills on the table. I'm very appreciative that Rep. Parrish and Rep. Hack also are offering leadership on this issue, submitting the same concept with some variation. I thank them for their leadership as well. But I know it'll be necessary for this committee to unite behind a single bill, so I'll speak briefly to the differences between the two bills here. And I would say that from my interactions with the chief sponsors, I believe that all of the chief sponsors believe in the concept of public participation and would be happy to move this concept forward, and there's not a jockeying for anything. So I think we should all be able to work together on a single bill toward a common goal. There are two points of differences between the bills. It's the number of hearings and the location of hearings. I'll speak to both of those. Otherwise, the bills are similar, in fact, identical. So our recommendation is that there be at least 10 hearings before and at least 5 after, and that's as it's written in this bill that we're discussing now. This recommendation is based on our experience during the last redistricting process of what felt sufficient without being too repetitive and what was manageable without being too burdensome for the legislature. We would certainly not oppose a larger number of hearings, but believe that 10 and 5 create, especially in this way offered as a floor, probably the best minimum standard. And leave some flexibility for the legislature. The other issue is the location of hearings. Our recommendation is not to be too prescriptive on location in order to allow flexibility for addressing areas of most concern. We agree with the provision in this bill that you're considering right now, prioritizing areas where there's been the greatest shift of population since the last redistricting process. We wouldn't oppose language that's included in the other bill to distribute the hearings equally, but we believe that actually the flexibility in this bill is the better route to go. So on those two differences, we would support the language more in this bill. So I believe that both bills move us further in the right direction, but this bill, HB 2974, more closely outlines the essential provisions that we initially represented as a coalition. And
was one of the other critical differences in, I think it was 2944, is that that the hearings should be distributed equally as opposed to where the biggest population changes happened, which is what the hearings were based on last, and that there should be no more than one hearing per Senate district, which is rather difficult when you have a Senate district, say like Senator Ferrioli's, where it goes from far eastern Oregon to Marion County, or Senator Hansel, or so I think that for me that was problematic, but having the flexibility to say, you know, wherever we need the hearing, that's where we'll have it.
Yes, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, I agree with you. It might not have been clear, but that is the difference. I'm speaking to the whole area of difference between how you handle location. And we feel more comfortable with this version that provides a little bit more latitude and emphasizes the areas where there's been most shifts. But the restrictiveness of the latter, which you just spoke to, we're less favorable toward. So.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Perfect.
Whoever is next, yeah.
Thank you.
For the record, again, I'm James Offsink, speaking on behalf of the City Club of Portland and the Redistricting Matters Coalition. And we are testifying in support of House Bill 2974, which would provide an open, fair, and publicly responsive redistricting process in 2021 and beyond. We believe that the public plays several key roles in the state's current redistricting process, and we believe that the roles will be preserved and enhanced through the passage of this bill. The first role played by community members, at least over the last three decades, has been to provide initial input to those who draw the lines, and that could be the legislature or the Secretary of State's office in the current system. We believe that Oregon's nearly 4 million residents have a better sense of the changes and developments in their neighborhoods than the 60 state representatives, the 30 state senators, and 5 members of Congress who currently represent them. We do not believe that this is a failure of representation, but a necessary aspect of our system, which assigns one state representative to 66,000 Oregonians. In 2011, hundreds of individuals testified to a variety of issues they felt were important in preserving and enhancing their community's representation. Our coalition, as Kate mentioned, attended several of the hearings and observed testimonies varying from the importance of watersheds to key transportation links and ethnic identity groups. When we interviewed legislators involved in the 2011 redistricting committee, they attested to the initial value of the hearings in focusing their work and also spoke to the value the visits around the state provided the committee with dedicated time together and allowed them to see districts that they would not otherwise have visited. The second role that the public plays, and one that we believe would be enhanced through the passage of this bill, is correcting unintended errors. With the many competing priorities of redistricting, it's only natural that small unintended mistakes are made, and due to the weight of redistricting, these can be compounded over a decade of representation. So in some cases, these unintended mistakes remove voter privacy by producing unique ballots for small sets of homes. In other cases, they produce administrative difficulties for county elections offices. These mistakes can be easily found and corrected once produced if there's opportunity for feedback after draft maps are released. We believe that a more open and public process allows community members, academics, and the media to review the draft maps and suggest fixes based on real proposals. I'll end my comments there. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Stephen Carter. I'm representing AARP Oregon. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, AARP Oregon endorses the concepts of both these bills, the idea that we would codify public hearings both before and after draft plans are produced. AARP's national policy states that civic engagement is extremely important for a democracy, and the public hearings is the way for the public to get involved in the redistricting process. It's vital that this process be codified in legislation. As to the differences of the bill, AARP feels as if there's good points in both of them, but we endorse the idea of flexibility so that the committee members in redistricting can hold the hearings where they need to be held. House Bill 2944 does speak to geographic diversity. It's important to have geographic diversity in the legislation. However, it's also important to hold the hearings where the most radical changes are occurring. With that, I'll end my comments, and I think we have another person testifying.
Unless there are questions. Right?
Yeah.
Questions of this panel, yes.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Just a little historical perspective here. As I was the chair of the 2001 Redistricting Committee on the Republican House side, I'm not sure there's any real magic here. I remember personally conducting hearings in Bend, Portland, Manzanita, and Newport, and my Senate counterpart held at least 4 hearings in other diverse locations around the state. So after going through those and actually chairing those, conducting those, I'm not sure there's any magic to a number being involved. But one thing that, a very exhausting process, too, to take the show on the road, because you have to take your whole committee out with recording equipment and all of that. What you say is true about the information prior to map making back in those days. It was very secretive. Both parties developed their own maps, and both were extremely secretive about methodology until we finally met together and rolled our competing maps out one day, and that was an interesting discussion that I'll always remember. But one part about the bill that confuses me a bit on 2974, and this is a great difference to what it used to be, hold at least 5 public hearings at locations throughout the state after a reapportionment plan is proposed, but before the plan is adopted. Now, maybe things have changed since 2001, but both parties had their maps. We could easily conduct the public hearings throughout the state prior to proposing the reapportionment plan, because these committees were made up of Democrats and Republicans, and we sat there and took testimony. But there comes a time when the maps go into contention with each other, and one comes out the winner, and usually the map of the prevailing party, the majority party here. So I guess my question is, on line 10 here of 2974, unless things have changed, I'm not sure how you would hold public hearings after a reapportionment plan is proposed, but before the plan is adopted. I'm not real sure how that would work.
If I can speak to that, Chair Hall. Thank you, Representative Hoyle, Representative Wilson. So in that case, in 2001, there were draft maps produced, right? Each party produced.
Right. Yeah.
And I guess we would see that there would be some kind of joint, those draft plans would be taken in connection around the state. In 2011, the process that we just followed very closely, there actually was basically one set of, there were originally
right.
multiple sets of maps,
right.
and then it came progressively together until in the end there was one map. So the process in 2011, which is about as good as it can go given our current system, this process would make precise sense, right? But even under the process in 2001, I think there is still opportunity for the public to provide feedback when there's actually something for them to respond to.
Follow up then. Then we could say then, for the purposes of this bill, both maps would be taken out on the road from both parties then.
I think that's
okay.
Yes,
yeah, it doesn't implicitly say that, but that's probably the way it would work.
I think that
okay.
would be right.
If I could just one historical follow-up here. In 2001, we got the complete education in how reapportionment can go and perhaps can go wrong. That was ultimately I think most of us remember when to deny a quorum, the Democrats, the minority party at that time, left the building and fanned out across the state for about a week, denying us a quorum. Ultimately, it went to Bill Bradbury, who composed the maps. And I remember we as Republicans saying, wow, look at his map. That doesn't meet statute. It doesn't conform with the statute at all. And so we sued. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found for his map. So we had we got the full experience in redistricting in 2001. So, I think there is something to learn from that. And it'll be a great process to go through this and see what comes of it. Thank you.
Did anyone else have a comment that they wanted to make to that? Okay. Yes, Representative Rayfield.
I just thought we might recognize one of the Democrats that may have fanned out across the state, the Honorable Barbara Ross, in the crowd, who I believe in 2001 might have been one of those Democrats. So I just wanted to, also was a Benton County Commissioner as well, so I just thought I would note that.
I believe my current roommate, former Senator Vicky Walker, was also in that troop of people there. The last time we did it, nothing like that happened. So I think there's a different way to go about it, and I'd like to see it go.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I might add, the two chairs called me at home and asked, you know, how does this work? And I said, it doesn't. Good luck. And so I was really, I've got to tell you, I was totally amazed when it turned out the way it did.
And I think where you're coming from is you'd like to see that type of process happen. And I really, really appreciate all the work that you've done and would very much like to see the kind of transparency and an ability to have input that we did have last time, because that was something that certainly worked well.
Madam Chair, if you and Leader McLean would agree now to 30-30 next cycle.
I thought you were going to say rock, paper, scissors. Yeah. Thank you, and I believe we have just Steve Carter.
Norman.
Norman Turrell. Oh, sorry, Norman Turrell. Sorry, Steve.
May I bring up Cappy Eaton with my...
Absolutely. Oh. Anytime you want to bring up someone from Lane County, I am in support. That's Lane County, not Benton County.
I thought you said Lane County.
Not Lane County, no.
Chair Hoyle and members of the committee, and the diminishing committee, for the record, my name is still Norman Turrell, and I'm still representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and the League of Women Voters is still a 95-year-old grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. They make me say that part. And I'll dispense with the rest of my introduction for the interests of time, but I would like to say the rest of this. Currently, there is no statute in Oregon that requires any public hearings before or after a redistricting plan is proposed, nor is there even any requirement for maps to be produced. The usual process is to list a whole bunch of census blocks in the bill, and that is the plan. There's no requirement for maps. We believe that these two bills would correct the shortcomings in the redistricting process for Oregon. During the last redistricting in 2011, the Special Joint Committee on Redistricting held hearings all around the state before a plan was produced. These hearings were so effective and so well attended that we believe the process should be codified. These two bills are very similar, and the League of does not have a preference between them. We suggest that the two bills be merged, and that would be appropriate. The League does not have enough detail in our positions to distinguish between these two bills. However, it's my opinion that what's important here is not the differences between these two bills, but that first that there be hearings before and after the proposed plans, and that the hearings be geographically dispersed. The fact that there might be a hearing in a densely populated area or a area that has a lot of line changes in it, they're probably going to be very similar areas anyway. So I don't think that this differences are that important.
Actually, I would say that maybe you should look through the bill. They're actually, although they both have very good intention, there are actually some substantial differences between the bills that would, I think, preclude people from being able to reach out as much as is necessary in the areas that are most needed, those with the population changes. And again, when you limit hearings to one Senate district, specifically when you have larger rural districts, or where you may have a Senate district where both sides have a lot of population change, I think that that's really an issue. I think the general concept is on both are the same. And what I hear you saying is that the League of Women Voters supports the general concept, but I would look at the details of the bills.
So, Chair Hoyle, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that the League positions cannot distinguish between these two bills, and that we don't. The important parts are that the hearings occur before and after the plans, and that they be geographically dispersed. And the details, I think the committee probably would do a good job locating itself. in my opinion. So in any case, I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss this legislation with you and urge that you move a bill forward on this subject during this session, again, far ahead of the highly political time of the next redistricting process in 2011. Thank you.
Thank you. Seaton, I believe that today is a special day for you. Is it not your birthday?
Oh, yes.
Happy birthday.
I moved to say something. My name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. Representative Wilson, I go back to 1973 when then Secretary of State Clay Myers brought a 12-member committee together to talk about redistricting. It was the session after the plan. And we made some recommendations. Finally, in 1991, Phil Kiesling, as Secretary of State, started the movement around the state. And it was very satisfactory, but people didn't have a lot of data, the public, to see that. And finally, in 2001 and 2011, the technology had improved tremendously. And so finally there were things on the internet that people could look at. And it was such a tremendous progress going ahead. And Aaron remembers having gone to a Chicago training for the 2001. Yeah, and so the progress has been tremendous. And the hearings, I went to a couple of the plan viewing sessions, and the public was extremely interested. And the more information that they can have, the better.
Questions or comments? No, thank you very much for being here. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on any of these three bills? With that, closed public hearing, and with no further business today, we are adjourned. Thank you. Oh, we're adjourned. We're adjourned.